Time for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. And Bruce, a book we talked about last week, been looking forward to hearing more about it, and I look forward to reading about it. Tell us about Here's the Pitch.
Well, yeah, and also the people I know out there who are members of the Sport Literature Association, Dick Crapo has a review of this up in the latest listserv. This is an interesting book. I wasn't sure how I was going to react to it because I was afraid. I've read some books recently that have been just such college professor books that they put me to sleep, you know, with just...
Wait, you're a college professor.
Yeah, but I you know, that's why I teach fiction primarily. But, you know, the kind of book that is so heavily footnoted and so heavily researched and so heavily cited, this has all the research that needed to be done, and Dick Crapo points that out in his review too, but it's also eminently readable, and it focuses, Roberta J. Newman, who teaches at NYU, focuses on the personalities and the trends. Now, baseball starts out using advertising on, you know, tobacco and beer and those kinds of things. And we often are using spokesperson without their knowledge or their permission. You know, I put a picture of Ty Cobb on your chewing tobacco. You didn't have to compensate him. But in the early part of the last century, Congress started looking at this kind of stuff and started looking at the snake oil salesman and started to begin to develop the rules we have now, the regulations we have now, that make baseball and all other sports and spokesmen use the products they say that they are endorsing. Mickey Mantle famously endorsed a brand of milk which he had never even seen. So it was really by the 1970s that changed. But what's cool about this book is it goes chronologically, and as it does, it lets us into what were the things, why were baseball and advertising so intrinsically put together? Well, the first place that baseball advertised was on the outfield wall, right? So there were signs all over stadiums, and all the outfield walls were like the boards today in hockey. They had advertising on them. Then they began to show pictures of baseball games. And then if you wanted to advertise on the air, which was people forget was illegal when television and radio started out. You couldn't sell advertising. It was not allowed. If you wanted to advertise in the air, then they would make sure that the camera showed your outfield wall advertising. And if you didn't, your outfield wall advertisement didn't appear on TV. So marketing became a key, and they realized early that celebrity marketing had a great value. So that people like Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, did very well in endorsements. But it really isn't until you get to the 90s that really takes off. And you know, Derek Jeter made $300 million in endorsements. LeBron James will make more money in endorsements than LeBron James will make playing basketball.
Oh, yeah.
Alex Rodriguez was pretty close. But what's cool about this is the way that everybody has to buy in, right? First, baseball doesn't want to ever, they don't want their games broadcast because they're broadcast, nobody will come out to see them. Then, you know, a little company called Gillette, speaking of razors, comes around and says, no, I think we can advertise. I think you can make it work. Well, on radio, it was a little more difficult. I mean, you could pour a beer and people could hear the sound of it. But once you get to television, I mean, there are guys drinking on air on TV.
Yeah.
Mel Allen, notoriously in a doubleheader by the time he had his sixth Ballantyne, was usually getting pretty loose. But it's the way that baseball has been, you know, it was the sport. We know there was the time when baseball, boxing, and horse racing were the big three sports. Baseball maintained it because baseball was the first one to become a TV event, a radio event, to be an event that was advertised in the papers. Let's think about it. The sporting news, when it started out, covered a little football, a little rowing, but it covered baseball. That's what it was. So when baseball moved from the cities to the country, because not that there hadn't always been teams there, but it moved there when television came, when radio came,
right,
then people started to look at baseball and say, these are the guys we want to be like. You know, baseball players are the big, rock, solid, virile, all-American guys. So the products associated with them then were thought to help your manhood. And in the early issues of the Sporting News, there were all kinds of ads, baseball-related ads, for impotence cures, for cures for venereal disease, for all this to restore your manhood. If you were a baseball fan, you could find the way to restore your manhood. What Newman does, and I'd be fascinated to talk to her about this, is take, there's a quote here I wanted to make sure I don't butcher, so I knew I want to get it exactly right. That these guys would anything you gave them, anything, Babe Ruth, you like dessert, yeah, you better believe it, whatever you want. She says that here that, we're talking about Wheaties was the first big thing. That was the first big cereal. Then Huskies and all these other things. She said the new back design was where the most important alterations were made. Supplanting Jack Armstrong, right, the All-American boy,
yeah.
Lou Gehrig became the first athlete to graze a Wheaties box, his image closely resembling one that might be depicted on a baseball trade card. By the 1930s, baseball cards were no longer packed with cigarettes. I mean, that's where you've got, you know, we think about the bubble gum that ruined our teeth. Well, think about the tobacco that ruined a previous generation. But it was like, if you smoke this cigarette, you will become Lou Gehrig. Or if you smoke Marlboros or Old Golds, whatever. So they're out there selling cigarettes to people,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Ted Williams did that, I think, for Chesterfield.
Chesterfield cigarettes and Old Golds, yeah, Ted Williams. So that they... And so for a long time, it's that kind of guy. It's a Ted Williams, it's a Lou Gehrig, it's a Babe Ruth. Then the color line gets broken, and a whole new area of advertising opens up. Not that Jackie Robinson is going to advertise to the white people, but the entire Jet, Ebony, the Chicago Defender, all these newspapers and magazines for the African-American community now had a marketable star. And then you get to that point, right? We now have baseball immersed everywhere, all kinds of advertising. Then comes the 1970s. And then comes Rafael Palmeiro selling Viagra. And now we have come to the full thing. I use it. I'm a great player. I'm a great fielder. I'm a great home run hitter. I'm a good-looking guy. You too can be just like me. All you need is Viagra. So they were not even marketing it at the time for what it's marketed for today. It was to enhance your life. So that a lot of things have come through baseball that have been in baseball advertising that were really either snake oil or they were meant to be something else. And the number of stars who endorsed anything that you gave them is phenomenal. And what we don't know a lot of times is that would be regional. For instance, if you lived in Chicago, you didn't know that Derek Jeter did Ford ads. Those were only shown in the New York market. You didn't know that Robinson Cano was shilling whatever he was shilling in Seattle because they didn't show it anywhere
else. You couldn't buy Yaz bread in Kansas City.
Right, exactly, exactly. And then you look at when the digital age comes, everybody says, oh, baseball's dying, it's done. You know, we had the labor strike, we had the steroids, baseball's going down the tubes. Baseball reinvents itself on social media by coming up with its own platform. And if you think of that iconic 90-second commercial tribute to Jeter when he retired, with even the guys in the Red Sox guys tipping their cap and Spike Lee from the left side of Yankee Stadium, Rudy Giuliani from the right side, it all ends up being intertwined with all of the Michael Jordan products that Jeter was then endorsing, so that virtually no star in baseball doesn't become at some point associated with one or more products. You ask a generation of kids who Joe DiMaggio was, right? Mr. Coffee.
Right.
They don't understand
that. Jane Levy, when she was on talking about her wonderful book on Babe Ruth, a big part of that book was the efforts of his agent to get him out there sponsoring, doing ads for anything and everything, and Babe's great desire to have a candy bar of his own, which was not the Baby Ruth.
Right,
that
right.
had nothing to do with him.
That's right. And it's interesting because Ruth is really the first one for whom he had an agent. Ruth got smart. He was the first one to get an agent, really. Ty Cobb didn't. He handled his own stuff. And that became the template for people that came after him. And it was amazing the way, and I didn't think about this at the time because I was a kid, that certain baseball players became national figures, even though they were on a team everybody loved to hate. I mean, I grew up a Yankees fan, and everybody who wasn't a Yankees fan hated the Yankees. But Mickey Mantle, Yogi Berra, Whitey Ford, these guys could pitch anything anywhere. I mean, people drank Yoo-Hoo that were wearing a Red Sox hat, right? And it's how the image of the player becomes so entwined with the product.
Well, look at what happened with Sears Roebuck when they signed Ted Williams to essentially be the spokesperson person for everything that they sold in the area of sporting goods.
Yeah, and Williams. And the other interesting thing about Williams is that he becomes a national star, not just because he's the last guy to hit 400, not just he's one of the best hitters of all time in baseball, but he doesn't come out of a big market. He comes out of Boston. Mm. He doesn't come out of New York or Chicago or L.A. And so they're so intertwined. Baseball could not exist without advertising. I mean, think about now. You're watching a game and right behind the stadium wall, behind the catcher, the ad changes right in the middle of a pitch, right? That you are so assaulted in a baseball stadium now that it's and in other venues too. But
yeah, and we talked about how earlier in the early days of baseball, a number of the owners also owned breweries.
Yes,
and saw the value in promoting their products. And baseball and beer have been intimately connected through the years through those sponsorships. But then you think of that great run in the 70s and 80s where you had the retired players coming back and doing ads for Miller Lite, and what a great success that was for marketing.
Oh yeah, and how a couple like the way they would use a retired player and a current player in an ad, right? When Levitra came out as a competitor to Viagra, Mike Ditka, Iron Mike, became it because it's like, if Levitra can't work for anybody, it'll work for Iron Mike, right? And the way they went out and looked for players that could really help the image of a product. Mariano Rivera, Derek Jeter were chosen very often because no scandals, no steroids, good guys, they didn't get in trouble. Both had the right complexion for people who were in some way of mixed ancestry. How that if a player, would disappear like Jason Giambi, some of that, they're big spokesman, boom, steroids, done, they're out of here, right? So that baseball didn't care, they just kept recycling them, grab a new one, grab another one. But if you watch the process, and this is what the book is so great at, from just putting it on a baseball card, to moving to the press, to moving to kinds of advertising, to being part of the newspaper, to suddenly when radio comes along, you're able to reach all kinds of other people. And once radio comes along, not all the advertising is just aimed at men, because it started out beer, smokes, razor blades, things that were supposed to appeal to men. And now you watch a baseball game and there's plenty of advertising that appeals to a wider group. Mm. You know? So it'll be really fun to have Newman on, because she can probably contextualize this, but in a way that would be better than me. But I was thinking about James Walker, who we had on Crack of the Bat, the history of baseball on the radio. And I thought one of the things he said about the book is really great. Studying the history of baseball without studying the history of its advertising partnership is like trying to learn rocketry without understanding rocket fuel, because the fuel of advertising created the money to become the behemoth that baseball is today. Because these guys now are interested in making money. As we know, Jacob Rupert, Tom Yawkey, Connie Mack, the owners that we've talked about in other books before, they were baseball people. It's like Upton Bell says about the NFL. They were football people. Now they're mega millionaires and mega billionaires, and all they care about is turning over that money, and advertising is doing it for them.
And also, as we talked about from the early days of baseball, it was a way to assimilate, and the ultimate assimilation was out there being the spokesperson person for some sort of corporate entity. That was when knew you had made it.
When Jackie Robinson was on the board of directors of Chock Full of Nuts, a lot of people would say, okay, African-American athletes have finally arrived at a place that goes beyond their natural ability to play sports. And the assimilation, you're so right, the way now Latin American players, there's a great section here on Big Poppy and Jeter and some of the other Latino players of that era, and how they became big spokesmen, and it didn't didn't matter if they had an accent suddenly anymore.
Right.
Because she calls it the Chico Escuela factor, which we remember from Saturday Night Live. Once you get past that, once you're not Curt Schilling doing that on the air, making bad jokes, you see that baseball has brought all kinds of people into the mainstream, and people sort of just assume that now, right? Here's the pitch, the amazing, true, new, and unimproved story of baseball and advertising. It's from the University of Nebraska Press, and Roberta J. Newman will join us on the 22nd of May.
Excellent. Looking forward to reading the book and looking forward to having her on the show with us. Next week, sort of a special, in many ways, hour-long Sports Lit 101, but we veer away from the Sports Lit to talk a little Music Lit with a friend of yours, a very talented writer, poet, talking about not only her book, but her experiences in the music scene in the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah, I mean, Ellen Sanders is the only person I know that was at Altamont, Monterey, and Woodstock as a working journalist. And she wrote for all kinds of major, from Crawdaddy, Rolling Stone, you name it. She wrote for all of them. And she chronicled it in two ways. Her book Trips was reissued, by the publisher, by Dover. She also has a wonderful new poetry, long poem called, sequence of poems called Hawthorne, about when she lived in Bolinas, California, which for people who don't know is northwest of San Francisco, I don't know, 10, 15 miles. And it was sort of the meeting place. But she'll talk about being on tour with the Birds, all kinds of people. She was there. I mean, she knew all these people. It's not it's not one of these sort of groupy kinds of things. She was a number one top rate journalist, and she's going to be with us for the hour on Wednesday. We're going to drive up from. She's going to meet me in Swanville, and we'll drive up.
Excellent. That's coming up next Wednesday on Sports Lit.